From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, GM's restructuring has a lesson for President Trump.
I think the president is being reminded that General Motors, the leadership there, does not work for him.
Lessons learned from a lifetime of farming in Michigan.
And money was actually fairly tight. But you know, the damn pigs was always good to me. I always had enough money to make the payments.
A World War II vet honored for his service as a Navy test pilot.
To me, war is hell. I didn't want the children to be exposed to the ugliness of war.
And Dear Black Women.
Dear Black Women started off first with our circle, which is a gathering of black women centering affirmations we've written ourselves.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Think back to 2016. Candidate Trump was campaigning hard in Michigan and through the industrial Midwest, promising he alone would bring back auto jobs. President Trump has promised his tariffs on foreign steel, aluminum, foreign cars and trucks. It'll all mean nothing but good things for Detroit. Well, this week's bombshell from GM has shown there is a pretty big disconnect between Trump promises and the reality of running a transportation business in 2018. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. And Daniel, I think we can be safe in saying if there's one thing this president cannot abide, it's something not going his way.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Policy choices have consequences. I think what you're seeing playing out in the auto industry right now is the pain that people from the Trump administration predicted that would, short-term pain at least, that would come from these tariffs is happening. But I don't think these people see a long-term path to the gain. How is it going to get better? You've got companies that have to deal with problems. They have to deal with the fact that fewer and fewer Americans are buying cars. There are a lot of forces that are driving this, number one. Number two, I think the president is being reminded that General Motors, the leadership there, does not work for him. They have shareholders that they have to answer to. They have their own company they have to run. And some of his prescriptions for how he thinks the industry can fix itself, in fact, won't fix itself. It'll just make everything more expensive and make them less competitive. And as a result, you're seeing General Motors do things that are politically unpalatable to the president.
And as you explained to us on Monday, GM is taking these steps to avoid the very situation that it found itself back 10 years or so when it was getting hauled to the woodshed by Congress and needed a federal bailout. Just kind of go into that for us.
Well, I think that's exactly right. Look, the people running General Motors today have a chip on their shoulder. They are not going to get in that situation again. They are going to take the steps necessary to avoid it. I think they believe in their bones that if they were to fall on hard times, seriously hard times like they did a decade ago, that politically most people would say, let them fail. They're not going to get to that point, and they've got to make some hard decisions. A lot of people are very freaked out, particularly in the cities where these plants have been identified as having no future product. But it is very, very important for people to understand these plants are not closed. They are not closing before Christmas. If I had a dollar for every person I've heard say that on cable news or politicians, it's just not true. And all they do is freak people out even more and get people all worked up and angry at the company and angry at the UAW. There are processes in place, contracts that bar these companies, or any company, but particularly General Motors, Ford, FCA, from closing a plant without the cooperation and negotiation by the union. So one of the reasons this is happening now and at the end of 2018 is we're going into a contract year next year. The fate of all of these plants and whether or not they get product, and by the way, if they don't get product, they will close, is all about union negotiation. This is the opening gambit, okay? This then creates a scenario where you have four U.S. plants that are on the bubble. So the UAW goes into national contract talks, and they start to negotiate for what kind of products can we get here? How can we do this? And this is a process that goes on all the time, and it's really been going on like this for the last 20 years when they finally baked into the national contract the language that said a company cannot close or idle a plant during an existing contract.
So that word unallocated is, when they talk about unallocated plant, is really key in all of this.
Absolutely. And I've seen some people make fun of it. And General Motors came up with a new corporate speak. Look, they did use an industry term. I grant you that. That's absolutely true. But I will tell you that the people at the UAW and down to the rank and file, they know that product allocation is the mother's milk of their livelihood. And if they don't have an allocated product into their facility, they know that that facility is likely to die. And that's what it's all about. So it doesn't mean it's going to close. It means that you don't have necessarily a future. So think of it this way. An allocated product is the future. If you're unallocated, you have a very uncertain future. And that's what this is all about. So some of these plants could be doing something very differently going forward. You know, you have geographic issues you have to look at. General Motors has already been very public about saying that people in some of these affected plants would be able to bid on work in other plants. Well, so if you're at Detroit Hamtramck, there's a lot of facilities in Southeast Michigan as a UAW member that you can bid on and go work in as if you don't even miss a beat, more or less. If you're out in Northeast Ohio and you don't have any facilities for 200 miles, that's a little more problematic.
And circling back to the president who has been aiming threats and a lot of anger at GM, where do you see that going?
Well, I mean, I think he's been very public, as I wrote in my column today. I mean, he's been very public about threatening the companies. First, he threatens them with losing their EV car credits, which is a law enacted by Congress, and the president can't unilaterally do that, from our best understanding. And then the next day, he threatens yet again tariffs on imports, which causes all sorts of problems for the car makers and because of how parts flow and everything else. I think you see here somebody who's flailing about, and we're seeing yet again his vindictive streak. I don't expect that this is going to change what this company is going to do. Just today, there are members of Congress from the Michigan delegation down in Washington metaphorically pounding the table saying the president needs to help General Motors reverse this. And I just don't think that that's going to happen.
And in fact, what do you expect to come from Ford?
Well, it's interesting. Ford has got a lot of the same issues. They're trying to transform their business. But Ford has got a probably arguably better plant utilization right now, plant capacity utilization. What that means is they're still moving people around, and they announced something yesterday on that front. They're still moving people around. But because they have, in general, higher plant capacity utilization, they are unlikely or less likely to take plant action. So I think you'd be less likely to see this. On the other hand, I think you're still going to see salary job cuts from them going into next year. We're going to be having these conversations. But remember, back in 2016, 2017, the president went after Ford because it moved production of its small car, the Focus-based car, to Mexico. And again, this is another case where the president has a huge megaphone, and he is criticizing them, and yet Ford brings two new products into that plant in Wayne, Michigan, Michigan Assembly, and the people working there essentially don't miss a beat. There were no jobs lost as a result of that. So that's one of the things these companies can do, but I think what happens is the optics of this gets way ahead of the reality of what's actually happening. Now, it does help the United Auto Workers, for the president and for members of Congress and for a lot of people in the media, to get all bent out of shape and get really loud and everything about all the terrible things that are happening. But the people at the UAW know what the process is, and they know that they're going to get a crack at renegotiating what goes into these plants. That's really what I think the negotiations next year are going to be defined by, is where our product's going to be allocated, and General Motors is going to be at the top of the list.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This weekend, the University of Michigan Musical Society is celebrating its 140th season of performing Handel's Messiah. For Robert and Bunny Carlson, the Christmas season doesn't start until they're sitting in that audience at Hill Auditorium.
This is really the beginning of our Christmas season.
This Sunday, the couple, who are both 92 years old, will drive from their home in Grand Rapids to Ann Arbor to see Handel's Messiah. It's a tradition they've done every holiday season for 61 years.
We first heard Messiah in broadcast in the early 1950s. In 1957, we heard the University Musical Society's performance on WUOM. So in 1958, we began our tradition of annual attendances at Hill. which has lasted for 61 years.
Each has their favorite part.
I love the, and he shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Almighty God. That is my favorite part. I know Bob has a different one.
Yeah. My favorite part is, come unto him, all ye that labor and are heavy laden. That's my favorite.
The Carlsons lived and raised their family in Clinton Township in Macomb County. They recently moved to Grand Rapids. As you can imagine, they've got many fond memories of their annual Messiah pilgrimage to Ann Arbor, from taking their young children.
When they were 5 and 6 years old, they managed to stay awake for a good portion of the performance.
To snowy winter evenings.
And our daughter has a particular remembrance of walking back to the car late at night in her little Mary Jane shoes in the snow up to her ankles. So it was memorable for all of us.
And just what does this long-standing Christmas tradition mean to Robert and Bunny?
Well, we realize how blessed we are to be able to celebrate the 61 years together and to have 61 years of traditions. And our children participate in some of them, but now, as most families, they have scattered all over the United States. So with grandchildren in 5 states and children in 2, it's difficult to be together. So we remember and we do a lot of reminiscing about our Christmases and our trips to Ann Arbor.
One of the things that a lot of us remember is one day there was a bat flying around in Hill, going back and forth and coming to a lower level, and finally went right over our heads, and I tried to swing my coat and knock him down. And then it was interesting because the conductor at that time was Donald Bryant, and he was the only one in the whole auditorium who didn't see it. The orchestra could see it, and everybody else could see this bat. And it was a disturbance, and he was rather concerned about what was going on and, of course, didn't know until later.
In total, there will be 37 in the UMS orchestra with 4 soloists and a chorus of nearly 175 voices. Performances will be this Saturday and Sunday at Hill Auditorium. And if you're there Sunday, you'll likely see Robert and Bunny continuing their special Messiah tradition. To Robert and Bunny, congratulations on 61 straight years of Handel's Messiah, and we wish you a very Merry Christmas. This story was produced by Michigan Radio's Mercedes Mejia. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You look around and you realize you are in the minority. You could hunker down and keep to yourself. Or you could take a cue from Florence Noel and create a positive space for yourself and others like you. Create a community. Florence Noel is a grad student at U of M's Ross School of Business and the School of Information. She is a woman of color. And at the Ross School, minorities make up only 23% of its full-time MBA candidates, while women make up only 43%. Florence has created Dear Black Women, an affirmation movement for Black women by Black women. We spoke with her earlier this year, and let's revisit that conversation now. So to get an idea what it was like for you when you came here to Ann Arbor to the University of Michigan, tell us about where you grew up and what that was like.
Yeah, I grew up in New York. I grew up primarily in Westchester County. That is the county right above New York City. Folks from New York City will be very, very, very serious about telling you that. And I grew up for most of my upbringing in a very, very diverse environment. It wasn't something that I noted because it was normal to have people from all over the United States and all over the world. And I was raised largely in a Haitian enclave with a pretty extensive Caribbean community as a part of my upbringing.
And here you come to Ann Arbor. What was that like for you?
So the thing is, people often say to me, leaving New York City, where I spent a good time in Brooklyn, and coming to Ann Arbor, were you anticipating that I'll say something bad? I have nothing bad to say.
So Dear Black Women, I see on the website, an affirmation movement for Black women by Black women.
Yes.
What do you do? What is it?
Yeah, so Dear Black Women started off first with our circle, which is a gathering of Black women centering affirmations we've written ourselves. It sounds incredibly simple, and the entry is very simple. You write yourself a letter, you submit it in advance, and then we make an experience out of it, centering everyone's letter. And what evolved into something I thought would take no more than maybe an hour to 2 hours can become a full day event, 6 to 8 hours, people blocking off their days. And the conversation is at once an opportunity to relieve yourself, to see yourself reflected, to get advice, to get information, to get connections. It becomes this great networking experience. From the first circle, which had 5 people, we've grown to over 500 in this local area and reaching over 4,000 nationally. And the vision for DBW, Dear Black Women, is to continue to build communities like this throughout the country and find ways through online communities to connect us more deeply.
So what was the impetus for founding Dear Black Women?
Yeah, the impetus has been a lifelong journey of feeling in so many spaces throughout life that being a Black woman can often feel like being a double, triple, quadruple minority, depending on additional identities you have. And it manifests in a wide range of ways that are captured in statistics when you look at the state of Black women in the country, but also in lived experiences of feeling like you're receiving microaggressions, you're not seen as the person who can lead, your voice may not be amplified, or if it is, it might be heard through a filter that has stereotypes all over it. And so this is not a recent development. It's been a lifelong journey of thinking through how you create spaces that affirm Black women and create opportunities for Black women.
Can you give me something that sticks in your mind when you were on the receiving end of this kind of microaggression that got thrown at you? You're like, where do you want to start?
I want to say, come on.
Put us in your shoes.
The examples are so extensive that it's almost painful to pull out one because none will represent all. But there have been incredible instances of leading things and having a lot of criticism come towards me where in the same situation to other people, it would not be the same. And understanding that despite working hard and seeking to achieve things at high levels, that there'll be an expectation of failure or of not being as good as you present to be as a function of being Black, as a function of being a woman, as a function of being a Black woman. And these aren't surprising. You find Black people from all genders experiences and a lot of women from all races experiences. What we often don't spend a lot of time looking at is how when you are both Black and a woman, how does that combine? These things that we're aware of people experiencing as women, people experiencing as Black people, bringing them together. Yeah.
So as you're working on your 2 graduate degrees and you're doing this, and this is a for-profit group?
Yes, it is.
So how is the revenue coming in, and how do you want to make this a sustainable undertaking?
It's for-profit intentionally because in my experience over 10 years in nonprofit before grad school, I've just understood how often nonprofits struggle with funding the good work that they're doing. And so the challenge for me is pinning down what the revenue streams for DBW will be. As of to date, it's been largely events. In time, I want to be able to introduce membership models that can create a whole class of things that remain free and accessible despite whatever socioeconomic background you're in, but then also offer additional resources and value to people who would want to be able to pay into a membership. Beyond there, there's opportunities for partnerships and sponsorships because this is a community of very, very, very richly talented, eager people who are in need of more access to resources and opportunities. And I believe we're at a time where the people who have those access and opportunities who would like to partner. So those are some of the initial thoughts.
And age range, what are we looking at?
Largely millennial women from, I would say the youngest has been 18. And we've gone into our 60s as well.
I was going to say, you need to get some of the women who've had a few years under their belt.
Absolutely. We have. Yes. Largely because it started within the university network and branched out, it's naturally been millennial women 18 to in their mid-30s. But we have now moved in spaces where we have more women beyond that age range. And all Black women are welcome.
Flo, how do you respond to someone who might make a point? Flo, we're in America in 2018. We are way too siloed as it is.
Yeah.
Is there a validity to that argument? Could it be seen as being siloed off?
I don't know that the word silo is the accurate word. I think if we are talking about the lived realities of people based on identities, then we have to appreciate that not everyone's experience is the same. And as such, not everyone's needs are the same. It is imperative that Black women have safe spaces where they can feel reflected and affirmed. And what that enables is more connections with people who have more wholeness, more happiness, more groundedness in who they are. If people are interested in conversations across the aisle and across different identities, you want it with people who are as healthy as possible. And that's what DBW does. It does not exclude what Black women can do outside of our community, but it focuses on making sure that within our communities we get what we need so we can be better people.
How can Black women who are listening to us talk find you?
Yes! I get excited. DearBlackWomenProject.com. You'll be able to sign up, and if you're in the Southeast Michigan area, you'll get notices about events, you'll get notices about resources and affirmations and connected to the community. And if you're outside of Southeast Michigan, we're going to be branching out shortly, so stay tuned.
Florence Noel, the founder of Dear Black Women, thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
Dear Black Women will host its 25th Affirmation Circle in Ann Arbor on December 16th. You can learn more by going to DearBlackWomenProject.com. Taking the very first step down a career path can be daunting. It's like stepping into a world that's completely unknown. On the flip side, if you've been walking that road a long time, chances are you have learned a thing or two. Today on Stateside, we revisit the very first conversation in our series, Work in Progress, a series of conversations between two people at opposite ends of the same career path. We hear from people who've made all kinds of career choices, from symphony conductors to priests, nurses, millwrights. Today, we turn the spotlight on two farmers.
I'm Frank Baffey from Homer, Michigan. I live out here north of Homer on the Cook's Prairie. And I've been here on this farm 40 years, but I farmed before, probably all my life, actually.
I'm Dave Camasara, and I live in Burlington, Michigan. Been out there for about 4 years, trying to start a farm.
Why did you decide to take the first steps into this line of work?
I moved out here from the Detroit area about 14 years ago to work in a hospital in Marshall, and I met some Amish people, and I took care of a little Amish boy. So that kind of started a long-term relationship, and you know, I still take care of the Amish community down here. So I've spent a lot of time with them and out on their farms and started learning a lot and decided to buy a farm. And when I decided to move out to the farm, I think it's the best thing I ever did. There's nothing more peaceful, and I don't miss the city at all, you know, the traffic, and it's beautiful at night. It's just quiet. Mm-hmm. You get up and you just see your stuff around you. It's kind of all right there in front of you, and it's nice. I like it a lot. How about you, Frank? You've been farming all your life?
Yeah, pretty much. Of course, I worked off the farm, too. I'm a journeyman pipe fitter. I worked at Ford Motor Company. I worked at Hastings Manufacturing and Clark Equipment in Jackson.
So you weren't born on a farm?
No, I was not born on a farm. I was born in Lincoln Park.
So how'd you start farming then?
I bought this place, saved my money. I worked at Ford Motor Company for 11 years, worked a lot of overtime, worked in a coke ovens, blast furnaces, foundries, you name it, every filthy thing I sucked in my lungs. Had enough money when I bought this place. This place was for sale, the down payment I could afford, and I did it. I moved my family out here, a wife and four kids.
Why'd you want to leave the city?
To get my kids the hell out of the city. Actually, I was raised in a rural setting, but the city grew up around us. And there's no better place in the world to raise a family than on a farm.
How do you think farming's changed over the years since you started?
What has happened is, basically, everything has changed because the margins have got so small. You know, you hear this thing, sustainable agriculture. Well, hey, if something isn't profitable, there's no way it's sustainable.
Right.
You know, I mean, you could come over here, and if you had 50 sow, you wouldn't be making enough money to pay your bills.
Right.
And there was when we bought this place 40 years ago, the pigs paid for this place. Of course, we had cattle too. And I was here, I'll bet you 30 years or better before I ever sold anything off of this farm that wasn't walking.
What kind of cattle did you have?
I had beef cattle, basically. I liked Herefords, but I'd cross them with beef shorthorn and red Angus. And as of late, I went with a black bull because everything is Angus beef,
right.
So, I mean, if you go in there and you got a black hide, you're going to get, it's not a grade, it's just the color of the skin. But if it's black, you can pick up another 10 cents a pound. It's economics.
Yeah, I was thinking of doing black Angus or crossing it.
It don't matter. Hereford and Angus, black with a white face, hey, you know, if there's a good market, you know what you do, don't you? You reward it. Now, do you plan on making a living on this in total
independence?
Total independent living?
That would be a no. Although I'd like to go that way. I don't want to invest everything I have and just take the jump and try to do that. So I kind of want to ramp up. And
yeah, well, you're still working as a, what are you working as a?
I do emergency medicine. But I would like to retire from what I'm doing and just work on
the
farm.
When you get to the point where you got enough and, you know, make sure you put away, you want to pay Social Security too.
And my taxes. So you're working for Ford, and were you nervous about making the jump from going into farming?
You betcha, because I left that place. I let that job go and came over here with the idea that I could get another job. I financed myself, really. I mean, bought the place and the breeding stock. Matter of fact, the first pigs I bought them on a Visa card. The biggest trouble was that, you know, times were actually, it was tight. You know, money was to make, because you had payments. You know, I had two farm payments to make was $7,000 a year. I was on a land contract. And money was actually fairly tight. But, you know, the damn pigs was always good to me. I always had enough money to make the payments. I don't know. So a lot of it, I think, was just dumb luck. You know, I mean, when the price was good, I had pigs to sell. And a lot of this thing, we give ourselves credit for stuff. But there's things that happened to me here on this farm and things I did that ended up real good. But it wasn't planned to be real good. It was just supposed to be a little bit good. If you're going to be doing this, another thing is, if you're like, you got pigs, man, you got to be able to take death 7 days a week. Because, you know, you can go out there, and I mean, I've had, there's diseases. I had one time over here, this TGE hit me over here in this barn. And hell, in 1 week, I lost 125 pigs die.
Wow.
And I think you got to have a stomach for that. Mm-hmm. You either got to say, well, hey, man, this is the way it is. It's the same way with butchering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to, some Saturdays, I'd kill half a dozen pigs, you know. It never bothered me. And the only thing that ever bothered me was maybe that it didn't bother me. But, you know, the thing, you know what had bothered me sometimes is the ones I took to market. Because I knew these pigs would be mixed in with other pigs. They'd be fighting. They'd be on a damn truck. They'd be going someplace and whatever the thing. Because there's times that if the weather was warm or I didn't think it was right, that I wouldn't sell them that week. I'd wait because I figured it was just too nasty on them, you know, and that was going to market. In your profession, you've got to be able to face that. Like I say, death is, with the livestock business, it just, especially with the pigs, you know, I mean, when you start losing them, why, you just got to suck it up and say, well, you know, maybe the next batch will be better.
I think I'd be able to handle, you know, the death of livestock. Obviously, you don't want it to happen, and you don't want it to happen in large numbers.
Yeah.
You know, and as far as butchering, I've been able to butcher some hogs, you know, with the Amish.
Mm-hmm.
And I've liked, you know, how, or the experience I've had, because they respect, you know, that animal, mm-hmm. and they know that animal is going to feed them, and it was a good experience, you know,
but
it was a humbling experience too. I think it's the thing of the hands-on, right? I mean, like, at least in my job now in the emergency room, you can take care of something or you take care of somebody, and you can see the benefit from that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can, like, fix them or get them on their way to being healed, hopefully. And, you know, out on the farm is that, you know, you see things that you're doing that make a difference or that, you know, are working in a positive way.
Yeah.
And so But you make mistakes too. I've made a lot of mistakes, but then you learn from those and try to do it again next time. Since you've been out here farming, what are some of the biggest mistakes you've made that you've learned from?
Well, some of the mistakes I made, I bought some livestock that I probably shouldn't have. As I was trying to get into this thing quicker, there were some of them pigs that I bought that was basically overpriced. And I mean, I got through it, but I could have played it a little better. And another thing is, I farm with junk. And looking back, I probably could have spent a little more money on a little better equipment. And maybe I had done a little better on the bookkeeping. I guess the government wouldn't have got as much, and I might have got a little more. Then, and like I say, the best thing that ever happened was that I got my family out here, you know, and I seen that the way my kids are now. I mean, they just barely put up with me because, you know, I'm the old guy. But I've always tried to be decent to people, and people have treated me pretty good too. The one thing there is in this world is there's a lot of good people. And a lot of people just waiting for a chance to be good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I say, you know, I may be often wrong, but I'm never in doubt.
That was veteran farmer Frank Baffy and new farmer Dave Comisara. They joined us as part of our series, Work in Progress. Up next, we hear from 98-year-old Harold Becker, a Navy test pilot who fought in World War II and Korea. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When it comes to saying thank you to the greatest generation who fought in World War II, you can never do it enough. And Sean Tracy has taken that message of thanks to an entirely new level. He's traveling through the Midwest, recording oral histories, and he's crafting veterans' tribute walls at Independence Village and Story Point, the senior living communities where he is the Veterans Project Coordinator. I sat down with Sean Tracy and with Harold Becker, a World War II Navy test pilot and fighter pilot earlier this year. Let's listen to that conversation, which originally aired in August. Sean, I'm going to start by talking to you about this mission of yours, recording oral histories, building these veterans' tribute walls, focused on the veterans, particularly your World War II veterans. What led you to this mission?
I've always had a deep respect and admiration for veterans. I've had a hobby of finding the veterans and asking them about their history, building them models to thank them for their service. And I became such an admirer of veterans that I decided to put myself through CNA school, become a certified nurse's assistant, and got hired at Independence Village in Brighton as a caregiver. And 6 months later, started my hobby again of interviewing veterans. And it took on a life of its own, and I was offered the position that I have now, where I travel all of our communities, and I take their histories and build them their models and just make sure that their stories get told and are recognized.
I know we're focusing on World War II, but are you talking to all the vets?
Any veteran, and it's not just American veterans. We actually have veterans of foreign nations. We have RAF pilots. We've had several German Army officers that served in the European theater, a Japanese survivor of the bombing of Hiroshima, you name it. If you wore the uniform of your country for your country, then I will absolutely interview you and do your biography.
And what do you do with the interviews then?
They get put on veterans' tribute walls. It's a designated area in our communities that has an American flag that was flown over the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. It's called the Capitol flag. The biographies, depending on the layout of the building, we try to put the biographies around the flag so it depicts the veterans protecting the flag. We also—
You take, like, bullet points from the interviews or transcribe the interviews?
I transcribe the interview. We're limited to one page because of the room mm-hmm. on the wall. Some of our communities actually have more than 40 biographies on the walls. So we're limited to how much room we have. So each biography is limited to one page. The interview itself or the biography itself is told kind of in a story fashion. It's not just bullet points and just dry. It's kind of put into a small story, and it focuses on their military career, their work career, and their family. It's not just solely their military. It's all encompassing of their life.
So I think I'm probably looking at Harold Becker's page that is from the Tribute Wall. And Harold Becker, one of these veterans that is being honored. And you went into the Navy in 1941?
That's correct.
Were you drafted or did you enlist?
Oh, heavens, no. I went down to Broadway and enlisted, much to the chagrin of my father, because at the time I was a student at Yale. But more important than that is I would have had a deferment because I was working at Winchester Repeating Arms Company, doing the support to the armies and navies. But I just felt the urge, and I had to do it, and so Dad had to put up with me.
Why did you choose the Navy?
Well, I loved the ocean. I loved everything about water. I lived right by the water. Growing up in New Haven, Connecticut, had my little boat.
So the water and the Navy were a good fit for you.
Perfect.
Now, you were a test pilot and a fighter pilot. What led you to fight your war in the air?
Curiosity. I knew I could do it, and I just had to prove it to myself as well as the service to make sure my fellow pilots knew they could do certain maneuvers and succeed and still come home all in one piece.
And that was the test pilot work. Did you start as a test pilot and then head off to do combat missions?
No. I picked up the test pilot when I got out of the combat missions.
Okay, so you were off to Europe after you got done your training to fight your war in the skies over Europe.
Yes.
What did you love to fly when you were fighting in the war in Europe?
Corsair.
Tell us what you did. I think people have an idea of the big heavy bombers, the flying fortresses, and the liberators coming and dropping the bombs. But what was your part in that battle?
Well, typical of that was like in Korea. I worked with the ground troops as close support, and they would tell me what their problem was, and I solved it either with napalm or 500-pounders with daisy cutter fuse. A daisy cutter fuse is one that explodes above the ground, so it's an anti-troop type weapon. That's the sort of thing I was doing.
How many sorties did you fly? Do you know offhand how many times you went up?
Heavens, no, I couldn't count the times. Not that it was so much and so many. It's just that I am 97 this month, and my memory is pretty darn good, but not that good.
So you would take off from an aircraft carrier.
Right.
And land. And I'm looking at a picture right now that you brought that we are going to take a picture of and put up on our website at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Boy, those seas could be choppy. What was that like, the takeoff and that landing?
Very difficult. That's the simplest, plainest way to say it. But if your hook skipped when the ship was like that, you luckily can go around again and land, but that was not a common thing because the ship rocked and rolled and you had to be at the right place at the right time. But when you get back from your mission of submarine searching, you're low on fuel, so you can't afford to mess around.
You need to land.
You need to be aboard and be safe. Yeah.
What are the emotions, Harold, that stick with you all of these years later?
That's a very difficult question because the thing I think was the most gratifying was when I was helping the troops in Korea, when they held down our troops from a ridge or something to the effect, and I heard, Scarface, is that you? Okay, Sonny, let's get this thing done. And I was working directly with the ground control people. And if it required napalm to burn them out, I've laid a lot of burn, including a couple of sampans, because the only way you can get rid of a sampan is to burn it, because you could strafe it all day long, but every little cubicle from the that's made out of bamboo, you could spend all day just shooting the thing up and you still probably couldn't get it down. So my suggestion to the skipper was, well, let me toast them a little bit. And I did. And they were getting too close to the carrier, and he didn't like that. So I said, skipper, I can handle that for you. And I did. And it burned beautifully.
You accomplished your mission. When did you leave the military, Harold? You went into the Navy in 41, and did you stay all the way through Korea?
Yeah.
So you were right through, even after World War II. Some people I know came back in, but you stayed with the Navy the whole time?
Oh, yeah.
When did you leave the military? After Korea?
I got out, but I was involved with Transport Aircraft Corporation as their test pilot. As a matter of fact, we did all of the filmed landings at the field to evaluate coefficients of lift versus drag versus getting aboard the carrier with the new jets. Because when you land aboard a regular prop job, you come in and you pull the throttle off, and the prop actually slows down to almost a stop, but it acts like an air brake at the same time, so you just put it aboard. But when you land aboard with a jet, you pull the throttle off, and the engine says, wait a minute, we're not going to stop. We have to wind down. Yeah. Meantime, you're halfway up the carrier deck and you don't get aboard.
So you need a whole new skill set and a whole new set of techniques to land those jets. You needed to develop those.
That explains it perfectly.
And you helped do that. And I see from, Sean, from the story, your history with Harold, after the service, Harold worked in engineering and sales, traveling all over the world. You got your bachelor's and master's in academics, engineering, and art, co-invented the plastic that is placed on plastic bottles, and was the first to put LED traffic lights in Los Angeles.
That is absolutely correct. Saved them millions of dollars.
And you and your wife were married for 34 years and had 5 children, who expanded the family to 8 grandchildren and 4 great-great-grandchildren.
That's about the size of it.
Well, Harold, did you talk to the family, to the grandkids, about your service after you were out of the military?
Very little.
Why?
Very little.
Why was that?
To me, war is hell, and I coined that expression, as well you know. But I didn't want the children to be exposed to the ugliness of war. It was like a movie. I wanted them to show, this is like a movie, but it's too gruesome for a child to have to accept that. But we made it like a game, so they wouldn't be totally upset and think that we were doing something bad, killing all those people. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They told me what to do, and I did it.
I know that there were veterans who came out of serving in World War II, and there was no such talk of post-traumatic stress disorder. People just were expected to go back to their lives. And I've known some World War II vets who really had to wrestle with some demons. There was a gentleman I met through Honor Flight who was a pilot on D-Day and accidentally dropped his load of bombs on an Allied ship, and it was haunted by that, and really had some problems for years until he finally came to peace. Did you suffer with any of that after, or were you able to kind of put it in its place?
The worst of it was being awakened with the roar of the engine, and it was loud and incredibly penetrating. and I would wake up in a fright. But I realized I wasn't aboard ship or aboard a plane or something like that, and quietly worked my way back into dreamland.
You know, Sean, I watch you as Harold is talking, and I can tell that this mission you've set for yourself means the world to you. Why?
Well, you just heard from a living, breathing piece of history. You cannot imagine what it's like for me to be able to speak to living, breathing history on a daily basis. These men and women are my heroes. They're a generation that we have to thank. They have to be respected. They have to be admired. They have to be honored. And it's just the most amazing thing to hear some of their stories. I can't emphasize enough their living, breathing history. And it's totally different hearing it from the horse's mouth, so to speak, as opposed to seeing it on TV or reading it out of a book.
Harold, you are about to turn 97.
Yes, ma'am.
You grew up in the Great Depression. You served in World War II in Korea. You have seen Vietnam, 9/11, the Persian Gulf War, 17 presidents. You've seen man walk on the moon. You've seen so much more. What do you say to young people who look at this world around right now in 2018 and they worry or they feel despair?
I tell them we are the strongest country in the world. And we have, and we've proven it, conquered all the bad, bad problems. We still have some nuclear problems that we have to resolve. And that's why the great concern is with the Orient, because they don't seem to honor the destruction of the new weapons. I don't quite know how they can rationalize dropping an atomic weapon. I've seen the results of that, and I don't want to ever see it again, and I don't want my children to see it.
And you think of these countries we were at war with in World War II, Germany and Japan, and now we're such close allies.
Oh, yeah. Because we have a potential enemy in the Far East. And it's one thing not to be prepared. Be prepared. I'm sure you've heard that expression. Yes, Mr. Roosevelt was very emphatic about that and did a wonderful job.
And Mr. Truman finished the job Mr. Roosevelt started, didn't he?
Yes, he certainly did.
What does it mean to you, Harold, to have someone like Sean so intent on setting up tribute walls, taking your history, and saying thank you?
As a matter of fact, that's the bottom line. All I can say is I never expected any kind of accolade whatsoever. I did it. I enjoyed and hated all this in the same business, but I'm here.
And so you are, and so you are. Well, World War II and Korean Navy veteran Harold Becker, we want to thank you for your service, and we want to thank you for sharing your story with us today on Stateside.
You're very, very welcome.
And Sean Tracy, Veterans Project Coordinator at Independence Village and Story Point, thank you so much for the work you're doing to keep these vet stories up and honored.
Thank you very much for the attention.
That means a lot to us veterans, Sean. It really does, because it, for the most part, want it gone, disappear, so they don't have bad memories.
And my job is to make sure that your history stays alive.
And I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
You're very welcome.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.